Well, it's 2 minutes after 4 o'clock, and this is 91 FM, WUHY in Philadelphia, and you're listening to Fresh Air. Tomorrow afternoon at 3:30, John Zwed will be reviewing, John Zwed will be featuring The Record Show, his regular Wednesday feature, and Thursday, Francis Davis will review new jazz releases on Interval. Friday at 3:30, Bill Van Wert will be with us to review a new film. Well, with me now on Fresh Air is Robert Rodale, the head of the Rodale Press. It was his father, J.I. Rodale, who launched the press in 1930. By the 40s, the press was devoted to issues of health and nutrition. The best-known publications were Prevention, devoted to natural foods and remedies, and Organic Gardening Magazine. They're still the most popular Rodale magazines. J.I. Rodale was an advocate of health foods long before natural foods became a concern shared by many Americans. It gave him the reputation of being a bit of an eccentric. It was an ironic tragedy when he died of a heart attack in 1971 following a taping of the Dick Cavett Show in which he was discussing the benefits of natural foods. When Robert Rodale took over the operation, he slowly expanded the scope of its information concerns and research. Now, in addition to publishing Organic Gardening and Prevention magazines, Rodale publishes The New Farm for farmers using organic techniques, Bicycling for biking enthusiasts, New Shelter devoted to home efficiency, the Executive Fitness Newsletter, health tips for office-bound managers, and Spring, a new magazine on health and lifestyle issues for women. Rodale books are published on many environmental issues, and Rodale research projects include the Cornucopia Project, an analysis of American food growth and distribution systems, and Rodale test farms, in which experiments are conducted on ecologically sound low-energy agricultural issues. Robert Rodale lives on a farm near Allentown, and the press is located in Emmaus, Pennsylvania. Rodale is the second largest employer in the town of Emmaus. It has a staff now of 800. Robert Rodale, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Most of the people of my generation, when they started turning to things like health foods and questioning the benefits of certain forms of technology, it was considered to be almost a rebellion against their parents and their parents' generation. Growing up in a family where your parents were leading advocates of health foods and organic gardening, did you ever rebel in any way and do things like eat foods in high sugar and espouse high technology?
No, I guess I didn't. My father and I got along together very well. People always ask me, what didn't you agree with that he did? Or they always look for some areas where we didn't see eye to eye. But actually, it was a remarkable association. And I worked for him for over 20 years before he died. And it's not that I always agreed with everything he did. He was always, as you say, as it's popular to say, on the cutting edge. And sometimes I just couldn't agree with at the outset of what he was doing. One time he announced that he thought milk was not a good food. And I said to myself, well, gee, now I think he's gone too far, you know. But after a while, and he explained it, the high fat content of milk and some of the allergic problems that result, it convinced me. I usually when he came up with some new idea, there were a lot of people who didn't agree with him, but as time passed, they thought, gee, he really was right. Maybe not entirely right. Like, I'm not saying milk, for example, is a bad food. You shouldn't use it. But his message was that to look at a glass of milk as like the best beverage and for an adult to drink 3-4 glasses of milk a day really doesn't make sense. And when he said that, which was like 20 years ago, he took a lot of criticism for it. But now it's quite acceptable.
Sure, it's one of the basic premises of, for instance, the Pritikin diet, that you should avoid foods that have milk content in it. When you took over the business, what was your idea of how the social concerns that you had should be balanced with the profit-making concerns of the Rodale organization?
Well, my father and I worked together very closely. I started with him in 1949, and we divided responsibilities up pretty much. Like, as long as he lived, he kept very tight control over Prevention magazine editorial, and I handled most of the administrative work and organic gardening and farming editorial. But what was the question you asked me again?
Oh, how you tried to balance your concerns, your environmental concerns and social concerns the profit-making concerns.
Right.
Of the
we agreed pretty early on that we wouldn't do anything just to make money. That was an agreement we had, and it wasn't that where there was any issue that brought it on, but we both felt that we had a mission, we understood what it was, and we both felt that our main thrust was to feel good about ourselves, really to enjoy our work, and that there wasn't any real push, there wasn't any reason for us to put profit high. So we just more like, I remember we were one day standing around out in the garden talking, we said, let's, you know, if we ever get in anything, let's ask ourselves, are we doing this just to make money, or is it because we really like it and feel good? And we both said, yeah, let's do it because we feel good about it. And it's worked out. And it's really a principle of business. Most businesses operated on that principle, or many of them did. Like 100 years ago, there was this tremendous craft, pride in craft. A business back in the last century was really the money-making side was in many ways subservient to the practice of the craft, whether it was manufacturing or newspapering or whatever. And it's only fairly recently that we've developed this bottom-line mentality in the United States. The forces of inflation, I think, is what has done it. And just the media age and keeping up with the Joneses, where you think young people think that my main goal is to make a lot of money in life. And I think a long time ago, people just didn't think that way. They went into the craft of their parents, and they took pride in their work. And we're like anachronisms in that respect. We think the number one, do your job well, and everything else will take care of itself. And it has worked out that way.
How do you think the corporate world views your operation?
They don't really understand it. The mentality that we have just doesn't fit. Like yesterday, I was in New York, and we had a reception at the Four Seasons restaurant for Spring magazine, and there were our ad sales staff was there, and there were all these account executives from different New York ad agencies, and our people insisted that I go. I didn't really want to go because I don't get involved in advertising sales. But they said, no, these advertising people said they want to meet you, so you better go. So I went there, and several of them said to me, you know, how come that they don't know of any other magazine that isn't part of some conglomerate? And they were really, they looked at me as kind of a strange bird because I'm still like a proprietor of a private magazine and not a division of some company. And they asked me a lot of questions like, what do you do? You know, how do you function? Why do you do things? It's a receding part of American commercial life. And it's very unfortunate. I don't know what can be done about it because there's so many pressures on small businesses these days. We've been really, I think that's the most, I consider myself an extremely lucky person, and I think the most fortunate part is to be able not to have a business mentality where the price of your stock is important. Because, see, that's what really, I think, cripples a lot of large companies now. All they need is like one bad quarter, not even a bad quarter, just a flat one, or even like if they predict they're going to grow 20% in the next quarter and they only grow 15%, stock market doesn't like that and the price goes down. That has a lot of bad ramifications for them in a business sense. And we have a lot of bad quarters, you know, where we have magazines that we published that have never made any money, or we have whole sections of operations that just are never going to make any money. But they're like, for example, we test all the recipes that go into our books, and we're the only publishing company that does that anymore. And it costs us something like $4,000 to $5,000 for a test kitchen to do all these recipes. And the issue came up not from the corporate level, but from the book editorial level. About 6 months ago, they said, "Geez, you know, it's the book business these days is not that good. You know, the cost is high, and so forth. And even we feel the pressure." So the book editor said, "How about if we stop testing these recipes? Make the author test them." And I said, "No." I said, "Maybe we do fewer cookbooks instead of doing 5 a year. We'll only do 3." But it's an assurance. I know we do catch mistakes there, and we learn a lot by going through this process. And then our benefits are other magazines and so forth.
Do you ever get bids to be bought out by conglomerates?
We used to. We haven't had any lately. I don't know why. But just about every one of the large media companies has come around. And we don't consider them seriously, or we don't consider them at all, really.
So you feel kind of separate from a lot of the corporate world. What about the world of social change and environmental activists who are perhaps surprised at the interest of a corporation in their work and in their concerns?
Well, it's an interesting question because we do function in some respects as if we were an association with a mission. It's just that we use a different medium and a different way of operating. And I think, we're quite effective at it. But the main purpose that we have, we focus on self-reliance. We're looking at the individual. We're good at talking one-on-one to people. You know, we know who we are. We have a pretty good sense who our readers are. And if you have any desire to help yourself to produce more of your own food or cook or make some of your clothes or remodel your house, you know, we're good at that. We can help you. We're not as good at the broad social issues. In fact, some people have actually criticized us and said, "Well, you know, you're sort of high grading, picking out the middle, upper middle class and showing them how to do it, but you don't, what are you going to do about people living in the ghetto or something?" And I'm a little bit concerned about that because my first reaction was, "Well, that's a tough problem and I don't have to have an answer to it." But I'm beginning to see that that's really not a satisfactory answer. And then also, we're all in a kind of ghetto environmentally. When there's air pollution, we all tend to breathe it. So that's one of my main concerns. I know on one of your list of questions asked me is about the Cornucopia Project, and that's an effort for us to deal with every issue of food. You know, not just gardening or not just somebody making soup in their kitchen, but a whole issue for everybody. And I'm spending now almost all my time thinking through how we can function in these broad issues.
Well, I want to get to the Cornucopia Project in a moment, but I know part of what you're trying to do now with the research projects is to influence people, right? I mean, because I think it's fair to say that you consider yourself an advocate of mm-hmm. environmental concerns.
Right.
From the research that you've done and the projects that you've done, what have you found to be the most effective ways of influencing citizens and of influencing policymakers?
Well, what we're really, with our research, we're looking for solutions. You know, there's plenty of problems. Sometimes what we need most is the questions to ask about the problems and hopefully the solutions. And what we've found is that sometimes the solutions are really very simple. Of course, we work mostly in agriculture. The research we do is more in agriculture and food than in other areas, but we're getting into a broader scale. I don't see, there are problems that people face, but there are many more solutions available, some very simple and practical that just aren't being used. It's more a challenge of motivating people to want to look for the right way to do things, a better way. And I have a feeling I'm not exactly answering your question, but what, do you want to rephrase it or something?
Well, I was wondering if you had developed strategies to reach people and to try to,
okay,
tell them about the problem that you found and the solution that you're suggesting, and then,
yeah,
try to convince them that it's worth following. Because if you're doing research and then are taking the role of an advocate,
mm-hmm,
in following through on it, I imagine a lot of your concern is trying to figure out how to reach the people you want to reach.
Yeah. Well, a method that we're using now is, again, this is being used in the Cornucopia Project. We develop what we call a technical secretariat on an issue. Many of while the solutions are simple in some of these situations, the problem itself is rather complicated, or it gives the appearance of being complex and difficult to understand. So step one on a problem like, say, what do we do about the American food system, is to develop a core of easily understood information so that the average person can say, yeah, gee, I never dreamed. I knew that food wasn't made in the back of a supermarket, but I didn't know how it was made. And now that I look at this little technical secretariat you've produced, I get an idea of how to do it and what my options are, what kind of subsidies need to be either added or taken away from the system. That's our major effort at the moment on issues, is to develop the information in a relatively objective way, not completely objectively. And then we do the best we can to publicize the existence of this information and to develop local groups. John Friedman, who's a professor at UCLA in the School of Urban Studies, has written a book called Retracking America, which is a standard text on transactive planning. And that's basically what we're doing, transactive planning, where we keep in close touch with the public. We gather information from the public and from technical sources, put it together. The technical secretariat is Friedman's term. And then he says we make it, you try to organize what he calls task-oriented working groups. And we're hard at work doing that with the food system. I know something is happening. It's hard to say that we're having an effect, but the areas that we're working in are changing, and I can see change for the better. We still have a long way to go, but I think that this technique, we're in a way a laboratory for this type of technique, and it's we're really simplifying the methods. Like one of the things we do is study the food system of the state. And the first state we did was Pennsylvania, and it cost us, like, in time, salaries, $30,000 to get all the numbers and the information in the state of Pennsylvania's food system. But we've got it worked out now. We have a little manual telling how to do it, and we can do it now for $1,000 on any state. And that's probably one of the best things we've done, is like made it simple for people to know what's happening in their state. And by the end of this year, we probably will have 25 states audited.
Robert Rodale is my guest. If you're just joining us, he's the head of the Rodale Press, and we're talking about a number of the projects and issues that he's concerned with. The research that you're talking about, of an analyzing of a state's food growth and distribution system, is part of the aforementioned Cornucopia project. How did you make that one of your priorities, the issue of food growth and distribution and topsoil erosion?
Well, people started coming to me about 3-4 years ago and saying, in effect, you and your father have been advocating organic farming for 30-40 years, and we didn't think much of it for a long time, but now with energy being a problem and their need for more employment, we know that organic farming is more labor intensive, and we know it's a more sustainable type of farming. What would what if society decides suddenly that the agribusiness, technological type of farming isn't appropriate anymore and we need organic farming? Do you have a plan to show us how to make the conversion? And I realized we didn't. And at that point, I had met Bedard Gabel, and I got him to come and act as a facilitator for the creation of this plan. We put together a group of Rodale Press writers and researchers and just thought it through. Now, and it became obvious to me very early on that the conventional food system was just not sustainable. It was burning up energy, soil, water, people at such a rate that it's before too long it just wouldn't function well. So at that point, we kind of moved organic farming off to the side and said it's still there, it's part of our thinking. But we said what we really have to do is alert people to the problem that they're eating. By eating food now, they're eating future food as well. That they're like one of the things we found out, that if you take a supermarket and put on top of it all the topsoil that is eroded in the course of a year to produce the food sold in that supermarket, you have a pile of topsoil 200 feet high. And we're developing images like that, information, and just letting people know that that's going on. The reason we call it the Cornucopia Project is that America still is a cornucopia. It is a horn of plenty, and it has a lot of potential to remain very productive. But there's also what I call a window of opportunity that's open now. It may be open for another 5 or 10 years. But if we don't change to a more sustainable system soon, that window will close and then we'll be really stuck.
What kind of reaction have you gotten to the research so far?
Really good. We've asked, we've been concerned about the reaction initially because we wanted to be sure that the research and that we were doing, first of all, that we were not duplicating some the other people were doing, and that we were doing it well and handling the numbers right. So we showed it to economists and other experts. And the answer we got was that, yeah, nobody's doing this. You're unique. Secondly, we think you're figures are good, you're handling information properly. But the third point they all made was, it's hopeless, forget it, you know, you just can't do anything. And so when I heard that, I took like a weekend off to think about it, and I came back on Monday morning and said, well, maybe it's hopeless, but we'll try to do it anyway. Because it's not, we're not using that large a percentage of Rodale Press resources to do this. And so for the past year, we've been plugging hard, knowing that it's an enormous challenge. And we do get a really good response. We have about 30,000 people now who've written to us and gotten on our free newsletter list. And there are like almost 200 people who have indicated that they want to start local chapters, like Cornucopia Project chapters. There's we held a meeting in at Lehigh University in June, and there's another one in Portland, Oregon this year. So there's these regional meetings. We're having another regional meeting here in, I think, I don't recall the date, but it's at Cedar Crest College. It's important, I want to emphasize that the Cornucopia Project is not an organization. There's no membership fees, no officers or anything. It's just an idea that happens to have a little bit of structure to it.
Well, the purpose of it is to try to figure out ways of reversing the trend of the erosion of topsoil, which you say if it keeps up will really deplete our natural resources and make it very difficult to grow food and to also have more energy-efficient methods of food distribution. This person told you that it was hopeless. You took a weekend off to think about it and decided to do it anyways. Why did they say it was hopeless? What's hopeless about it?
Well, first of all, we're more than just concerned about topsoil. We're concerned about the tremendous structural problems of the food system, that food is just produced so far from where it's eaten, and there's the supply lines are so extended, and the water, you know, we're using up our irrigation water. Right now, the most crucial situation in the whole food system is the financial condition of farmers. There, you know, the auto industry is in really bad shape. Housing industry is very bad, and farmers now are just in that category. So this wasn't what we expected like 2 years ago when we got into it. But it's, you know, you're talking with a food system. It's really like the biggest industry in the United States. And it's true only 2.5% of all Americans work on farms, but about 20% of everybody works in the food business in some way. And to change any aspect of that, is given the size, is very difficult. But there are there are options that people have, and they're using them now.
You've started a new project on the medical system. Would you just give us a brief overview of that project?
Right. Well, because we publish Prevention Magazine, and I write for Prevention, so I'm very aware of the issues. My thrust is always to think of how can people prevent illness? What can they do in their life? What kind of lifestyle can they adopt that will allow them to become healthier? But shortly after we got into the Cornucopia Project, I began thinking that there's a commonality between the food system and the medical care system, that both are very large, and the medical system has not been set up with a thought of sustainability. We just assumed that whatever was needed was going to be available, whether it's bricks to build hospitals or money or energy or personnel or whatever. And the financial condition of the medical system, or the financial impact of the medical system, is now so obvious. It's everything else is kind of either flattening out or contracting, most everything. But medical system, the costs are still going up and expenditures are still going up. And they, I just don't think it's sustainable. And I think it's a vulnerable system. And it's, again, we've found that there hasn't been a really careful, informed study of the whole system from the lay person's point of view. The doctors have studied the medical system, the hospital administrators, the drug makers, and the government has studied it. But just the ordinary people who are intelligent and are willing to dig for the facts have not looked at the whole system and said, hey, this is what we think is wrong, and this is how we think it ought to be made right. So that's what we're doing right now.
Okay, Robert Rodale is my guest, the head of the Rodale Press, which is located in Emmaus, Pennsylvania, near Allentown, and we're talking about some of the issues that he has been concerned with over the years and projects that the press is involved with now. You talked about self-sufficiency and how that's one of the ideals that you have. How self-sufficient do you think of yourself as being as an individual?
Well, I'm not quite, and certainly not as self-sufficient as I'd like to be. I prefer to use the phrase self-reliance. Self-sufficiency implies like isolation and total lack of dependence on others, which isn't a good thing. But we all need to explore our potential for self-reliance. I'm kind of torn between two things. One, I have a tremendous sense that these are really crucial times in the United States, and that I have, through the work the Rodale Press can do, you know, a lot of opportunity to do things. So, and on the other hand, I have my own life to lead, and people ask me, you know, like, what are you doing for yourself? So I tend to work a little bit too hard. And but I really don't, like, I'm consciously restricting my use of the automobile. I try to, I do more bicycle riding when I can. And I've changed my diet. Not only, I analyze my diet not only for health purposes, but can I put the cornucopia ideas into use in my selection of food? We've made changes in our house to switch it away from oil heat. And
what are you using?
We're now burning anthracite. We tried. Our house was built like 25 years ago, and it's just not set up for solar energy. But at least I feel good about not burning oil in the house.
What kind of diet do you have?
Well, I like to eat just about anything, not exactly in moderation. I don't eat much sugar, and if you compare what I eat to so-called ordinary person, it'll look pretty strange. To me, it seems rather normal, but I eat a lot of fresh vegetables, try to whole grains, fiber. I avoid butter and margarine and oils.
How come?
I just don't think it's, I don't know if there's time, but my theory of diet is that we really are very primitive inside. It's not that we are what we eat, but we are what our ancestors ate, to borrow a line out of last week's Newsweek. There's an article on it. But I believe that we have a genetic memory of how we were 50,000 years ago. Our minds have changed, but our bodies are still the same as they were. So I tend to think when I eat something, does my stomach really remember this food? And certainly doesn't remember a high-fat diet, because in a primitive environment, you couldn't get it. Doesn't remember a lot of salt, because primitive people couldn't get much salt. It does remember meat, but not real fatty meat, because we were eating very lean animals and fish. So it's a simple method and can be used easily to plan a diet, or at least to explain. I use it to explain why I eat what I do, and also to try to anticipate what people are going to be eating 5-10 years from now. We do quite a bit of work in that anticipation.
How far does that hold up? Like, it was many eras, I guess, before man was cultivating the soil and growing vegetables, being an agriculturally capable person. So if you eat a lot of, like, say, broccoli and cauliflower and zucchini, how well does that tie in with the primitive stomach notion?
Well, that's a really good question. See, actually, our evolution stopped probably about 50,000 years ago, and agriculture is only 10,000 years old, roughly. And what has happened in prior to agriculture, people ate about 1,500 different food ingredients. And that, of course, spread out all over the world. But even, right, like primitive people right here in the U.S., or what was the U.S. Before the white people came, maybe ate several hundred different food items. And with the coming of agriculture, people tended to select those plants which were good crops. They immediately screened out some of the weeds and semi-wild plants that people ate. And what has happened is we've come down to where we're now, like 90% of all the food that's produced in the world comes from 15 plants. And like 80% comes from only 7. So we're into this very narrow range of plants, which is not in tune with our genetic memory. We need more. We have use for more variation than that. Also creates a lot of vulnerability of the current system. If anything would happen to any one of those plants, or there's like two in the United States, maize and soybeans are enormous importance. And so there's a need to get variation. And that's one of the motivations I have in my diet, to eat as many different things as possible. But I'm really not a nut about it. You know, if somebody invites me to their house, I'll eat anything, or I even deliberately go out and eat just what everybody else eats once in a while, just so I get a sense of what people are eating these days.
What have you learned doing that?
It's getting harder and harder to do that. Well, there are changes underway. Like, there's a strong movement right now to reduce the salt content in processed foods. the message is getting to the food companies, and we've just absolutely got to do that, because the connection between salt and high blood pressure is really solidly connected, and there's so much of it comes in through processed foods, and people don't even know they're getting it. So, and the cost of coping with the effects of high blood pressure is so high, we just cannot afford it. So that's part of our work with the medical system, to develop these numbers and say, look, folks, you've got to cut back on the salt. And the food companies are doing that.
You know, it's interesting. There's a commercial that's been getting a lot of play. I've seen it a few times this past week on television, where someone is furiously shaking salt on plates of different foods that are passing them by. And I forget exactly what the copy is, but it says, are you a saltaholic? I think mm-hmm. is the word. And then I figure, oh, gee, this must be from the anti-salt agency or something. They tell you to cut out salt in the diet. But it's actually for a salt substitute. Hmm. And in the positive part of the commercial, the person's shaking on lots of salt substitute onto all mm-hmm. these plates of food, passing them by. And I thought that was a pretty interesting comment on like how we cope with habits that we have that we think we should break for our health purposes, and how difficult it is to break sometimes. So you find a substitute instead of figuring out a way to do without it.
Yeah. Well, with salt, if you go on a low-salt diet for about 6 months, you really lose your taste for it. It takes a fairly long period of time. And, of course, I've reduced my salt content pretty low now. And if salt just doesn't taste good to me anymore. But we've got to get people over that initial hump. And
What gives you the most trouble as far as how you ideally want to regulate your body and the things that you might like in spite of yourself, in spite of your best wishes for yourself?
You mean me personally?
Yeah. Do you have to wrestle with any foods or caffeine or anything like that?
I don't really have that much trouble. I don't know. I guess I'm just not that typical of Americans. I may be an easier person to make changes. And it's because I work with the information I do. I still do have an interest in caffeine. I drink a cup of black tea in the morning. I've given up coffee almost completely. But when I'm writing and things are going slow, I'll have a cup of strong tea just to help along. I think, the Renaissance, they say, happened because of the introduction of coffee.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah. there's no question that caffeine is probably bad for you, but it sure helps you do your writing, I think.
Right. Now, I understand you also don't like lawns and that you think they're, a potential high-energy waste of land. Is that it?
Well, to me, lawns have enormous symbolism, and the symbolism, I don't think, is really understood. They originated to give to the home a feeling of a farm. They're like... first lawn happened when a farmer staked his cows out around his house, and the cow cropped the land, and he said, hey, that's nice, I like the way that looks. So what we're still doing is manicuring this grass to make it seem like that we live really on a micro farm. And I think there's a place for lawns, and they're potentially very productive, but people put enormous amount of resources into lawns and a lot of care and aggravation, which isn't really appropriate. So, like, the amount of fertilizer that's put on American lawns would really keep India going probably for a year or something like that. I don't mind weeds in my lawn. I never do anything to mine except have it mowed once in a while. And then I like to either have it mowed high or... we have some lawns around the office where we never mow at all. We just let it grow up wild. In fact, we had some legal problems with that, where the borough came and said, there's these weed ordinances, you have to keep it trimmed. But there's a lot of places where Americans could actually enjoy their lawns more, their areas around their house, if they'd take a more laid-back attitude toward them.
So does your lawn give you any problems because of the weeds and because it's not like a real golf course looking type lawn?
No, it does everything we need.
What do you use it for? I always figured if I had a big lawn that I would, like, picnic on it and sunbathe on it and lie around in the grass. And I'm always surprised that so many people who have big lawns, they look really pretty, but you never see somebody out on it. You know, I've never really had one.
Well, the main function of the lawn, I think, is visual. It's, you know, to be able to look out the window and just, it has an enormous psychological advantage. I'm sure we're like most other people, we sit on the lawn a couple times a year and that's about it, you know. But there is this enormous psychological feeling of beauty or calmness about looking at it. But my point is you can have the same feeling by letting the grass grow a little longer. And if you really understand the value of some of the weeds that grow in the lawn, you like looking at them as much as the bluegrass.
The Rodale Press has been one of the most vocal advocates of health foods and natural remedies. And that's been an issue that's, in the past decade especially, become a common concern of many Americans. And there's an industry that's boomed around that issue. There are stores devoted to it. Mm-hmm. It's no longer considered a kooky fringe occupation of eccentrics. What are the pros and cons that you see in the, shall we say, commercialization of organic foods and natural remedies, natural foods? I don't know if you'd agree that it's become kind of commercialized.
Well, yeah, it sure has. Anything that's sold is commercial. I see the health food industry as having the major value is to introduce new and better foods to the mainstream eventually. Now, and some of the very important foods that everybody eats had their origin in health foods, like cornflakes, for example. The whole breakfast cereal industry originally started as a rather extreme branch of the health food marketing. And there are now things out there in the health food stores that will probably have similar impact in the future. They already have, like the fiber business, which is of enormous importance to our health and is now, like, take white bread, for example. The health food people have been saying for 50 years or more that white bread is not good for you. And 20 years ago, the only place you could get whole wheat bread was in the health food store. And now, actually, white bread is on its way out. If it wasn't for McDonald's using white flour in their buns, there'd be almost enormous decline. And even Wonder Bread now is coming out with a wheat loaf and so forth. So if you look, like, driving down here, I passed a health food store, and there was a sign in the window that said they're selling spirulina. I don't know if you know what that is, but an organism. I can't think of the name right now, but it's a very high protein substance that grows very dark green, extremely high protein, can be produced rather efficiently, and I think at some point it's important that we learn about spirulina and maybe use it in mainstream food. We haven't reached that point now, but in health food stores, it's being sold and people are eating it, and we just don't really need that much protein. I don't think. It doesn't taste that good, but it's there. And the health food store is the niche where spirulina can get its little toehold in the American consciousness. It may be used inappropriately now. But what technology hasn't been used inappropriately in its early stages? So that is really the major function, I think, the major value of the health food market. We're doing a lot of work with this amaranth plant, which is a major, potentially a very valuable crop plant. It's now being sold in health food stores in a cereal.
What is it? Is it a weed?
Well, some forms of the plant are a weed, but It's been used for thousands of years by people in Mexico, South America, and Asia as a grain. It's the only grain that isn't a grass. It's another type of plant, and it's very high in protein, and it has especially a good quality protein, and tastes good. We've been working with it for about 8 years, trying mainly to tame the plant so that it can be harvested mechanically, and we're at that point now, and many major food companies are interested in using amaranth. We've supplied the grain to just about every one of the large food companies, and they all recognize its possibilities, but the supply isn't, it's like a chicken and egg situation. The food company says, well, okay, can we go to farmers and get 10 trainloads a year of amaranth seed? And we say no, and the farmer doesn't want to grow it in that quantity until he can be sure of a good market. You need the infrastructure. But the health food industry is set up now to use small quantities and get it planted in the people's minds and in the market next year more and so forth. So it's very valuable for that point of view.
Are there any aspects of the health food industry that you're skeptical of or that you're wary of and you consider to be a ripoff?
Well, less now than in the past. There's been a lot of changes. The whole natural food thrust started in health food stores. The old-fashioned health food stores dealt a lot in foods sweetened with cyclamates and saccharin and so forth, the so-called diet foods. There are tonics and herbs now being sold now that maybe of marginal value, but I think on balance, the health food stores do an enormous good. There's, the real controversial question remaining is about vitamins and supplements, and I don't think there's any question that they're of enormous value. But I realize it's kind of a political. There's like a political position that people get into. They either are for them or against them, or it just doesn't fit their ideology. And it's more of an ideological problem than a nutritional problem.
Well, I think one of the criticisms that some people have had of Prevention magazine is that it's sometimes too simplistic in saying that if you eat certain foods and take certain vitamins, that problems will clear up, or that you wouldn't get the problems in the first place. How do you react to criticisms like that?
Well, the most much of the criticism we get is like really black and white. The people say, well, nothing in Prevention is right. It's like the biggest source of nutritional misinformation in America. And on the other hand, many of the readers say, I listen to everything, I read everything, and I do everything you say, and I believe everything. The truth is that we're really very conservative, that if you read Prevention carefully and if you have a relatively open mind, you'll see that for the most part it's a very conservative magazine and we're not recommending anything wild. We do kind of give the readers rather free rein in the mailbag department to tell of their experiments, and many of which are intuitive. But even that part, I know there are researchers who read that mailbag to see what people have tried, and they're looking for ideas because that's the way real innovation starts. But there are these people who have an ideology that the only thing that's good in the way of food is something that comes out of a box or has a stamp of approval of some professional nutrition association on it or something, and it's kind of hard. They're coming around, though. It's hard to reach them.
Do you take lots of vitamins yourself?
I take a reasonable amount. I don't know if you want to know the exact amount. It's about 15 tablets and several vitamins and minerals. They're really foods. They're concentrated foods. And one of the major points that I make is that primitive people, really, almost all their foods were vitamin supplements in some way. They didn't know what vitamins were or minerals, but they knew that they had to eat certain plants or animals to feel good, especially at certain times of the year. So they were very knowledgeable about what made them feel good through trial and error, and they ended up having probably a much higher vitamin diet than we do now. If you analyze a lot of these 1,500 plants that people relied on in the past, you find extreme richness in vitamins and minerals. So what vitamins and minerals are primarily is a way to introduce into our diet some of the concentrated nutrients that we used to get. And the fact that so many people today are exposed to environmental problems makes it even more important that they get it.
Robert Rodale is my guest, the head of the Rodale Press, if you're just joining us. President Reagan has suggested that the private sector should take on much more responsibility for social programs and art programs and research programs, and his administration has cut back considerably on federally funded programs in those areas. As the head of a corporation who's involved in a considerable amount of research projects, do you consider yourself to be part of that Reaganomics plan? And what do you think of the plan and of the ability of the private sector to pick up the slack from the federally cut back programs?
Well, I feel that there's a tremendous over-reliance in, or people overemphasize the impact of politics on their lives, or politics as a potential solution. I think that's one of our basic messages, is that, you know, you have within yourself the power to do a lot more. And well, I'm not saying that the federal government isn't important, but it certainly is. But I'm much more, let's take this question of research money. The crucial issue is, like, what is, whether it's supplied by the government or a private enterprise, what is being researched? And much of the work that's going on now is wrong, and they're ignoring, like, take the medical field. There's only a tiny amount of all research money that goes into prevention, tremendous amount into cure, and it almost seems like the more difficult something is to cure, like cancer, the more they put into it. And but cancer is a really fine example for discussion. There's a lot of potential for prevention, and yet there's almost a minimal effort going into cancer prevention, and this enormous war on cancer into the cure. So I think that is the important thing. I'm in favor. I think there's certain things that need to be funded by the government because they really are not commercial. There's no product that's going to come out of it. But we've got to address that question of what should be studied, what is important, and then try to decide where the money comes to do it.
Do you not think that the source of that money is ultimately that important? It's other issues.
Well, it is important, but you see, the what is more important are what is in the minds of the people who are making decisions about how that money is used.
Mm-hmm.
And we've allowed to be created this enormous scientific bureaucracy of people who really are very confused and have visions in their head that I just don't understand. And there are also a lot of connections between, there's a lot of government-funded research which is going, it is creating products that are being sold by industry, particularly in agriculture. There was a time when a good percentage of all agricultural research money was contributed by companies making chemicals. Well, now they've got it down to a science, really, so they just have a little tiny trickle of private sector money into the land-grant college system, which is funded by the government, but they're almost all doing work to show farmers how to use more pesticides, more fertilizer. So the industry is having their cake and eating it too.
We're running out of time, but there's one final thing I'd like to ask you. I know you're very conscious about health and the negative health effects of stress, yet at the same time, you're the head of a very large organization. There must be a lot of stress in your life because of the decisions that you constantly have to make and the issues that you're involved with. How do you balance your working commitments and your commitment to taking care of your body?
Well, I'm in pretty good shape as far as fitness is concerned. Well, first of all, I don't have any health problems that I'm aware of. And I've at various times done a lot of walking, running, cycling. So I have my weight under control. So I probably am spending more time working than I should. But I put it a lot of emphasis on fitness and diet, and I don't smoke, don't take drugs. I don't know. It's very hard to be objective about yourself. I think I'm doing okay, but I really am so aware of the important nature of what is happening in the United States right now, that this is like a time. See, sometimes the biggest events in history don't appear as headlines in the newspaper. They happen over a period of months. But there should be a big headline, like in every day's newspaper, that America is changing right now. You know, we are hitting the wall in certain segments, and we've got to develop these other strategies, you know, right now. And there are a lot of people who I think have this insight and are trying to work at it. I'm one of them, and there really isn't any time to waste.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing some of the research that you're presently involved with and some of the strategies that you're trying to cook up. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Rodale has been my guest. He's the head of the Rodale Press, which publishes many magazines, books, and is involved in a number of research projects. Many of them deal with agricultural issues, such as the Cornucopia Project, which is involved in assessing and critiquing the food growth and distribution systems in America. Thank you again, Robert Rodale, for talking with us.
Thank you.
Minute to 5 o'clock, and we'll be joining National Public Radio in just a minute for All Things Considered. Let me tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. At 2 o'clock, my guests will be Wendell Young, the president of Local 1357 of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, and Sherman Kreiner, the director of the Philadelphia Association for Cooperative Enterprise. We'll be discussing employees taking over their plants and possible union takeovers of plants and how that works. At 3 o'clock, Joanne Alter will be here talking about part-time careers. John Zwett at 3:30. At 4 o'clock, Seamus Heaney, the Irish poet, will be my guest. And we expect that somewhere between 4:30 and 4:40, we will be joined by trumpeter Wynton Marsalis. So I hope you can join us tomorrow afternoon. Technical director for today's show have been Dan Lachlan and Jay Goldman. Production assistant is Maeve Magoor, and the associate producer is Danny Miller. My name is Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Support for this program comes from the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the German Marshall Fund of the United States for international news coverage, the National Science Foundation for the coverage of science, and the Chubb Group of Insurance Companies, worldwide personal and commercial insurance underwriters. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Sanford Unger.
And I'm Cokey Roberts with All Things Considered.
This is what put us on the map, and we're losing it. When we say sponge industry, this is what we're talking about. This town was, it reeked with dignity. And all of a sudden, we've been swallowed by the rest of the world. And I say, no, let's fight back.
George Baliris, he and other members of the Greek community in Tarpon Springs on the west coast of Florida have made their livelihood from sponge fishing and tourism. Both are now threatened. Tonight in All Things Considered, what happens when tourism starts to take over?
And a Florida treat tonight, key lime pie, straight from a Key West kitchen.
Also these stories, an attempted coup in Guatemala. The far-right wing, unhappy with election results, wants to take charge.
In Israel, Prime Minister Begin tries to resign after a tie vote in parliament. The cabinet won't let him do it.
We have a conversation.